Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and here's what I've learned from late 1970s to late 1980s rock and roll about deception. On the album Some Girls by the Rolling Stones, track 5, Lies, Why do you have to be so cruel? Lies, I ain't such a fool. Remember that? Quick lesson from that, lying can really ruin a relationship. The Eagles taught us that you can't hide your lying eyes, and research has shown that, in fact, it's quite hard to do so. Our body gives away all sorts of subconscious tells when we're being less than honest. And, of course, Guns N' Roses taught us to, quote, use your illusion. This one's the most provocative. There's actually a role for self-deception in our day-to-day life. Well, Robert Trivers has done considerably more research for his new book than simply listening to a few rock albums. It's a rigorous look at the role of evolution and deception in both the animal and human kingdom, the evolution of deception. But it's all in there, how our body changes when we lie, how lying affects our relationships, and the power of illusion, self-deception. Trivers is a professor of anthropology and biological sciences at Rutgers. His new book is The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. Professor Trivers, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
And we did put out a call for listeners, and we'll take a few of you with the biggest lies that they have ever told themselves. 212-433-WNYC. Listeners, if you're willing to fess up, 212-433-9692, because maybe somebody can learn something from your experiences. You're an evolutionary biologist, and much of this book is grounded in the idea that we have evolved to incorporate a heavy dose of deceit in our lives. Why?
Well, the argument for deception is trivial, and we share the tendency to deceive with all other species on Earth in one form or another, or almost all others. So just to take an example between the two sexes, you can tell your wife or your partner that she's the only one in your life, the four children you have are all the world to you, and not tell her that you have a child by another woman. Might be down the street, might even be in your own home. As long as you get away with the lie, you've gotten an extra unit of reproductive success, to put this in straight biological terms. Of course, when your wife finds out, the marriage may be over, but the marriage was probably dying anyway. Now, at the same time, Maria, in this imaginary couple, she could give a child to her husband and say, you're the father of the child, when no such thing is true. And we know from a very large and impressive literature now on birds, starting from the 1980s when we were able to DNA birds' nests, and we found out to our surprise, biologists did, that 20 to 40% of the young in many nests of small songbirds were not the offspring of the male that was raising them. They were outside, resulted from outside copulations, and we have excellent data that the females tend to choose males whose genes are putatively superior to the genes of the male who's raising the offspring. Likewise, if they get away with it, he'll keep working, but we have evidence in some species, at least, that if there are signs of this going on, the male may reduce his work. So the Senegalese have a nice folk expression for this dilemma: better an ugly child that resembles you than a good-looking child that resembles your neighbor. So the key about my book is not deception. That's a relatively trivial problem, but self-deception.
Right, and the examples that you've been giving us from the human and other species are basically deceptions of others, and the reasons for lying to others are often obvious if we think we're going to gain an
exactly.
advantage in some way. So where does self-deception come in, evolutionarily speaking?
Well, that's been the key problem for a long time. And for a number of years now, I've had the notion that self-deception could evolve if it improved our ability to deceive others. So as you pointed out in your introduction, there are many tells, so to speak, that we're consciously practicing deception. One that's very hard to counter is a tendency for our voice to rise, especially as we come to the key word in a lie, because we tense ourselves up unconsciously, and any tensing of your system will tend to have your voice rise. So to give you one absurd example that happened a few years ago in my life, a woman was denying a homosexual relationship with another woman, something I was not, in fact, accusing her of, and she said, "You think I'm there with Sherry?" And her voice shot up two octaves because her voice broke under the stress. And I thought to myself, well, I did have a theory, but now I have some more evidence. So the point is, if you're self-deceived, then those avenues of detection are unavailable to the observer. You will not show conscious knowledge of deception, and furthermore, your deceptions will often be organized for you unconsciously, so you'll suffer minimal cognitive load. That's the driving argument behind self-deception. It evolves in the service of deceit, the better to fool others.
Let's hear a few examples from the real world. Megan in Orange County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Brian, and thank you for your program. I listen all the time.
Thanks so much.
Well, my lie to myself lasted for 39 years, and it consisted of stating and believing to myself that I was deeply in love with my husband, even though he was unkind and even abusive, that I stayed with him because I was in love with him. After he died, I came to recognize that, in fact, I had simply stayed with him because I was afraid to be alone.
Wow. That's a big one. That's profound to come to that realization.
Yes, that's a very interesting and honest case, and I congratulate you for the latter, your honesty. The interesting thing is that it was only the death and disappearance of your husband that seems to have put you into a situation where you realized fully, or realized for the first time, that really you had been living a lie, and now you were faced with what it was you were afraid of, living alone. So do I take it that living alone didn't turn out to be nearly as bad as you had feared?
That you invest the lie with other people, you know, so you get, oh, you're such a loving wife, you're so devoted, et cetera, et cetera. And the more that goes on, the harder it is for you to say, but I'm really not happy. You know, because now you've told everybody,
right?
Yes. And then it becomes difficult. So that's why I think when he died and I no longer had to convince that public of mine, my family and friends,
right?
Then I was able to say, you know what, this was really a colossal waste of human potential, both his and mine.
Wow. Megan, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
For your candor, and hopefully a lot of people can learn from that experience. Dave in Clinton Township in New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. Big fan of the show.
Thank you. Your self-deception?
My biggest self-deception is that I constantly tell myself that I'm a smart enough person to just rely on being smart, and that I don't really have to work that hard to do things that I need to do, and if I struggle with something, it's not worth doing.
And then what? You find yourself floundering, and you think, oh, if I had only worked harder on getting ready for this?
Not really. It's more like if it doesn't come quick to me, like if it's something that I don't pick up quickly, then it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm. Dave, thank you very much. Probably another kind of common one. Professor, we've got about a minute and a half left. I'm curious if you have any reaction to the Penn State scandal, particularly the behavior of Joe Paterno and the administrators who didn't report what they knew about Jerry Sandusky's behavior. It's certainly a case of deception, maybe of self-deception about the seriousness or what kind of guy this is, or maybe of illusion and disillusion.
Yes, well, I certainly think it's all of those things, and it's extremely common because we've just had the news last night that Syracuse has gone and fired their assistant basketball coach, and that's because two other men have come along alleging that he was molesting them, plus a recording from his wife way back in 2002 saying she was aware of what was happening in her own home with the first alleged victim. Mm. So this is an extremely common pattern.
David Brooks in a column called these normalcy bias.
Beg your pardon?
David Brooks in a column called this a kind of normalcy bias.
What
right?
Do you
where
mean
people
by C
shut
bias?
Shut down when confronted with something completely that breaks their perception of what's normal. Willful blindness.
Well, bless Brooks. He reads social so-called science selectively, but I would say that yes, people are very naive about sexual molestation of minors, and that goes back to Freud himself.
Robert Trivers, his new book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. Thank you very much.